21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
The first day we biofueled up my founding father's art car has gone down in my book as a red-letter day, thanks to a dedicated bunch of volunteers at the Baltimore Biodiesel Co-op. Baltimore now has our own dispensing biogas pump available to our community, and anyone with a diesel vehicle can fuel up today and enjoy the benefits of fuel from U.S. farms instead of foreign oil. Of course, you should do your research first, and the best way to do that is to join the Baltimore Biodiesel Co-op. Visit www.baltimorebiodiesel.org. That's baltimorebiodiesel.org. No wars required.
Hi, this is Shirley MacLaine. Happy 20th anniversary to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
I'm on.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is the alleged Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer is Laura Cordner, and our engineer is Jake Bryant, and we are on a mission from the King. Well, thank you, Slim and the Supreme Angels. If you go to the AVAM, or the American Visionary Arts Museum, and see their present exhibit, The Marriage of Art, Science, and Philosophy, and it's of more than 50 visionary artists, you will be reminded of Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 film, remember that one? Wherein we learn we are the same stuff of the stars. Or, as John Lennon sang, we all shine on the moon, the sun, and the stars. Now, as we discussed last hour with Stephen Hawley Martin, quantum physics gives us a deeper perspective as to what is to be human, or what it is to be human, especially in regards to this hour. Quantum physics may just be the way of visiting the stars in deep space and other galaxies. In this hour, Paul Hirsch, the author of This Way to the Stars, or How Quantum Physics Changes Current Space Propulsion Paradigms, Making Intergalactic Travel a Possibility, and published by Timeless Voyager Press. Now, author Paul Hirsch has written a provocative book about space travel according to the laws of quantum physics, and most scientists agree that it is impossible using Newtonian propulsion or exhaust systems to thrust a rocket to distant planets in faraway star systems and galaxies. However, very few have used this fact to demand alternatives. And Kirsch suggests this alternative: transcend the back exhaust paradigm and its limitations and make the ship a giant electron, enter higher dimensional space, and then join a pulsating photon a year light away. Wow. And then he notes this. He said, I am interested in fanning the spark of a new way of looking at our world, namely that we are approaching the technological capability of entering deep space, and that surely thereafter we will have a culture of migration into space, and this will profoundly shape our sense of what it is to be a human. And joining us right now is Paul. Paul, you there?
Yes, I am, Bob. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I really enjoyed this work. I would not have understood your work if it were all a bunch of words. I got to tell you that, Paul. it's a bit beyond me. But I think the way it is laid out, most people, including myself, can really understand this in a different way. Would you like to say anything more about what I referred to earlier on about the capability of going into deep space and why migration is so important?
Sure. First, I want to start and say that my book has pictures on every page and makes it accessible to the general public. And then I want to mention that I'm not a physicist, but I comment on what physicists do. So I'm sort of a liaison. And I like to explain things in simple terms to people. And I've been studying some interesting ideas about space propulsion for a long time. So I wrote the book based on the ideas of some others about a space probe that could theoretically travel interstellar distances. And I want to emphasize that these are the theories of Mike Miller and Larry Moore, and they're just theories at this time. But I want to go and answer your question about human migration and how it leads to space migration. Now, I'm going to give you the classic model as I understand it. And there are other models of migration that I've heard on your show. I'm less informed about them. Anyway, around 70,000 BC, Homo sapiens begin to leave Africa. Then around 40,000 BC, they migrate to Australia, Asia, and Europe. And 20,000 BC, they migrate across the Bering Strait. And it's interesting, the sea levels, and Homo sapiens followed prey across the land bridge and through the Americas. There's another major wave of migration in the 15th and 16th century where Europeans are interested in trade routes to the east. Now, of course, there's negative aspects like exploitation, conversion of native peoples to their beliefs, but there are positive things like the aspects of search for freedom and expression of beliefs and ideas. In the 18th and 19th and 20th century, there's yet another wave of migration of Europeans who come to America for economic opportunity and rapid industrialization and escape the oppression endured by certain minority groups like the Jews and Armenians, and famine for the Irish. There's an interesting book called Living Off the Land and Space by Matloff that was an influence on me on some of these ideas. Anyway, in my book, I hope to influence young people to think about deep space travel. And it's an interesting thing. It's often the young people who explore, who leave home, and it's the older people who tend to be rooted. And here again, I was influenced by a book called Interstellar Migration and the Human Experience by authors Finney and Jones. Now, I want to switch a little bit and give a little biologist story. When water organisms are in a closed test tube, they multiply until the resources are used up, and then they die off. So obviously, there's a human parallel here. As we use up the resources, we'll need to move on. So my book describes how we have the beginnings of a scaffold for the development of technology to interstellar travel, and then I believe human migration will follow.
Well, what is very striking, the cover is very striking, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but the ship that you're talking about looks like, almost like a cigar in shape.
Right.
There have been numerous cigar-shaped craft photographed in and beyond our atmosphere. And after we talk about the ship and its propulsion and things like that, if we had time, I'd like to ask you about that, because this is the same. If what we are seeing up there are these very large, 2 mile long, look like almost like submarines in the air, they could be using this type of propulsion system. Well, anyway,
right.
But what we need to do is talk about that particular type of propulsion system. Could you, what are some of the examples of space migration in the pop culture?
Oh, yes, there's many connections between space migration and pop culture. There's a song, for instance, I've heard recently by Enya. It's called My, Time Flies. It's in a new album. And hear the lyrics, my, time flies, one step we're on the moon, next step into the stars. So that's just an example from popular music.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, so many TV shows and movies have to do with space migration, space travel. And I think it's quite it's ubiquitous.
Well, one of the most valuable things I found in your work also deals with the with your related references, and especially that is in your appendix, and the glossary of terms. Now, we're not going to get much into that, but I want, and the area dealing with The History of Advancements, which hopefully, if we do have any time to talk about some of these great men that began this theory. Now, old versus new methods of propulsion. Obviously, as you've already noted, liquid fuel, it ain't going to work if we're going to try to get to another galaxy. Maybe if we had a ship that was 575,000 miles long, we might be able to do it. We could carry enough fuel, maybe. But certainly not within any one particular lifetime and that kind of thing. Let's talk about this breakthrough propulsion system that you've been talking about, that you review in this work, especially in the HAL, in the introduction of the book, the probe.
Okay. Well, first I want to say that the concept is very novel. It's a whole new model. It's not the back exhaust system of like a rocket. Instead, we're mimicking quantum tunneling on a macro scale. And it takes time to adjust to this. It takes time to view things a different way. It takes time to consider it could be done. But I hope to encourage a whole new chapter in space research that the back exhaust propulsion system of rockets is on its way out, just like gas-powered cars. In the beginning of my book, I review why people might want to travel into space, and I review the things I mentioned about maybe important for our collective survival. And then, as you just mentioned, there are limitations to rocketry. You run out of fuel. And this kind of physics, the rocket exhaust system, is really 13th century physics, where you had Chinese fire rockets were used to fight in battles then. Anyway, so I'm suggesting that we look for alternatives. And, of course, one way is to warp space. But the critics have said, well, it takes a lot of energy to do this. And we have some theories about that, as I will describe. Let me get a little water here. One second.
And now, friends, I want to note that we say that this is well illustrated. Every page has got color illustrations on it, especially one that I'm looking at now. I'm going to hold it up to the microphone. Those of you who have been listening for the past 20 years are going to be able to see this really clearly. And those who are newer listeners, you're going to have a rough time with it. But is a teardrop shape. Now, we've talked about teardrop shapes in the past on 21st Century Radio and their importance. I'm looking at right now what would be referred to as the ship. And I note that it is shaped in the form of a teardrop. Could you tell me why?
All right. Well, the ship is composed of two parts. One part is a hull and one part is a lens. And the hull part of the teardrop is like a cone, and the lens is like a cap to that cone. So altogether it forms a teardrop shape. And what we do is we project a radio frequency from inside the ship at the lens, and this converts the energy into three spinning lasers. And at the end of those lasers is an endpoint we call the anti-ship. And we think that shape may be important. In the book, I have the ship overlapping with a bar magnet and iron filings. And you can see how that shape produces sort of that cigar shape, actually, that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And I show how the probe fits in one end of that cigar shape.
What is the probe?
Now, the probe is an unmanned vehicle. And this is how our first plan. At a later date, we'd like to have a manned vehicle. Or person, a passenger vehicle.
Well, I noted that the ratio of length to width is the golden mean. There's been a lot of discussion on the importance of the golden mean aesthetically, but this might mean something else, that somehow the golden mean is linked to the possibility of something else?
Well, some of these questions may be better answered by the researchers themselves, but it's my understanding that it's sort of like a fractal pattern where you have the same pattern repeating across scale from very large to very small. And there's a fellow named Matti Pitkinen who does some writing about that kind of thing, and it's pretty interesting. But we'll say that the shape of the ship does play an important role in the function of the ship.
Now, how does this operate? You project a laser beam from the front or the wide part of the ship, And this laser has a powerful, massive, rotating, positive electric charge and magnetic field at the end point, which you mentioned. So how does the ship actually move?
Well, I'll go through a series of steps.
Yep.
To illustrate that. We say that the ship is like a giant electron, and it has a negative charge, and it's very powerfully attracted to the endpoint, which has a positive charge. And it tunnels through space to get there. And it's interesting, there's a theory called the Schwinger effect, and he suggests that an electron may tunnel to a positron to get to the positron. So there are some established theories on that. But we're doing it at a macroscopic scale.
A macroscopic scale, not
microscopic.
Yeah,
that's a large.
Yeah.
Not a large size scale.
Now, the hull of the ship has a unique skin. What is it?
Oh, well, we say that the hull of the ship has a niobium tin covering to it, and that's laid down very carefully, molecule by molecule. And if you imagine, like, sticking a plug to it, that whole thing becomes charged and becomes like a giant atom. The whole surface of it is alive and crackling. And so that the surface is very important. The material of the surface of the ship is very important to create something called a Bose-Einstein condensate, which is it's like a whole giant-sized atom with a charge around it.
And you have a synthetic diamond coating at the outermost layer. And what is that? What's the function of that? What is the function of that, that diamond coating?
Well, the theory is that if we put passengers in there, that will help to protect the passengers and be a further insulating material.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these questions are maybe better answered by the researchers. That's my current understanding of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to need to take a break, and when we return, I'd like to begin a discussion as to how this ship moves through space, how it tunnels.
Okay.
And that's really, this is fascinating stuff to me, friends. And most importantly, I can understand it by looking at the various, every page has got, God bless Paul for making sure that us old men can read. The print's large enough and it's colorful enough for me to read without my glasses, and I really like that. We'll be back with our guest Paul Kirsch, This Way to the Stars, How Quantum Physics Changes Current Space Propulsion Paradigms, Making Intergalactic Travel a Possibility. It's published by Timeless Voyager Press. Go to thiswaytothestars.org. Phone number is 1-800-576-8463. UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com is the place to go to check out my latest book, a beautiful gallery of over 70 illustrations with many in color, plus ones we didn't have room for in the print version. Read some of the intriguing stories and other content we cut from the book for lack of space. Order an autographed copy online along with coffee mugs, pins, medallions, and other books available only at UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com. See the reviews of my latest book from Willie Nelson, Shirley MacLaine, George Norrie, Graham Hancock, Stanley Krippner, and many more. UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com. Check it out today.
No matter who we are or what we do, our health is a priority. To stay well or to recover from an illness or injury, consider using options that are safe, natural, and in some cases, thousands of years old. From acupuncture to modern-day massage, counseling, and homeopathic medicine, the Ruscomb Mansions Community Health Center offers children and adults numerous health care and support services. Find out more about the Ruscomb Mansions yoga classes and weekend programs. Call 410-367-7300. That's 367-7300.
This is Henry Bauer. I'm editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and this is a show that is most worth listening to.
My goodness, that's Enya. Is that right, Enya? My, time flies. One step on the moon and the next step to the stars. And I think they're very appropriate for the title of Paul Kirsch's book, This Way to the Stars. And of course, if you want to get a copy of This Way to the Stars, it's published by Timeless Voyager Press. You can go to thiswaytothestars.org or call 1-800-576-8463. This is a very complicated and difficult subject to talk about, and I've been thinking about this for days as to how to try to create the images for our listeners to see. But I think what I'd like to do, we talked about the basic shape of the ship and the hull of the ship. Tell me, let's start with this shape again, and go from A to Z as to how you want to this ship moves through space and tunnels, and of course describe what tunneling is all about.
Okay, well, I was thinking we might think of a dumbbell, you know, like a weightlifting dumbbell, and there's two kind of large things on each end, and then a joining piece in the middle. And so in our case, we have an electron on one end and a positively charged object on the other that could be a positron. And the electron is very powerfully attracted to the positron, and it wants to go there. And we create a tunnel by there's spinning lasers that create a magnetic field. That's sort of where you put your hand on that barbell. Mm-hmm. And that magnetic field also has a twist to it, and it's like a vortex. And we go through the center of that vortex, and the magnetic field is sort of provides a wall, a protective wall, that the ship would go through. Now, there's something else that is interesting that's happening at the same time. We say that as the ship starts to go into that tunnel, it enters into something called a Schrodinger probability function. That is, as it's drawn to the anti-ship or the other end of that barbell, in the Schrodinger probability function, the ship could be here, it could be there, it could be anywhere in space. And we say that in 11-dimensional space, every point is connected to every other point. And once it's in that 11-dimensional space, it joins with a pulsar, with a photon that's at a distant place, like a distant star. So let me step back a little bit and say these are very difficult concepts. But the idea is that in 11-dimensional space or in higher dimensional space, every point is connected to every other point. And Mike Miller, the researcher with Unitel, describes it as like hairs on a dog to a central body. So if you're at the end of one of these little hairs, like any point in space, and you go a little distance, and then you're connected to this central body, or like this the center of the dog, and then you come out again, follow this little hair to another point in space. And I thought that was an interesting metaphor. It helped me kind of understand this central space where everything's connected to every point is connected to every other point.
Now, you mentioned 11 dimensions, and later on you discussed the first, the first three and then the fourth dimension. Could you touch on the first three and the fourth dimension and what the other seven might be?
Sure. We know of the dimensions of up and down and front and back, left and right. These make up the first three. And then there's time. Now there's seven others. And we don't ordinarily see them, but we see evidence of them. For instance, scientists often wonder, why is gravity so weak compared to some of the other forces? And it may be because of the gravity that we exist, that gravity may exist in these higher dimensions. And so gravity may not be as weak as we think it is. At least that accounts for something called dark matter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it holds the gravity holds the universe together.
Could you say a little bit, talk a little bit about dark matter and how prominent it might be in, well, in our universe?
Right. I'm not an expert in that area, but it's my understanding that there's a great, that something's holding the universe together, and they're working on theories of what energy is holding it together. And the theory is that these other, that gravity may extend in these other dimensions and hold the universe together as it is.
And so this matter is invisible?
I can't really speak about that. I'm more generalist, so I can't go into details about that.
Okay. Now, in regards to when you call tunneling,
mm-hmm.
What is tunneling?
Well,
because this seems to be an important process by which the ship would move from one dimension
right.
to the next.
Uh-huh. Well, tunneling is not such an esoteric thing as it might sound. For instance, the first example of tunneling was in a paper in 1928 by George Gamow. And so, you know, 1928 to 2009, it's been a long time. So tunneling is not so foreign. And I also want to mention that it's used in things like the scanning tunneling microscope, which has been around since 1981. So although people talk about tunneling, it seems like a pretty exotic thing. It is used in current day with a scanning tunneling microscope. And our idea, again, is just to do tunneling at a larger scale, at a macroscopic scale.
There is, before we get into we've been talking a little bit about the how here, but there is an area here that I wanted to touch on before we get to our next break. By the way, the front of the ship that we have it on the cover and inside the book, spherical type, has three colors, red, green, and blue.
Right.
And you talk about synchronicity. Just the other day, for some strange reason, I was watching War of the Worlds. Do you remember that movie, War of the Worlds, 1955?
I sure know the name. I haven't seen the movie.
Well, the actual lens of the eye, of their mechanical eyes, were just like this. Red, green, and blue. I mean, I'm not saying that that's exactly what they were referring to. It's just that being an artist, I'd like to see coincidences or synchronicities, so to speak, because it seems that synchronicities are extremely important in regards to when we talk about this quantum physics along these lines. But there is the area I'm trying to... I'd like to get to this one area, but it's very difficult to get to. But let's get to distortion of space. How does one distort space?
Oh, right. Well, the distortion of space has been around a long time since Einstein's theory of general relativity. And then there was a paper by Lenz and Thuring who kind of followed up on that and showed that space could be distorted. It's not a terribly new concept. The typical example of that is the rubber sheet analogy, that when you drop a bowling ball into a rubber sheet, it gets distorted. And so any strong gravitational pull could distort the fabric of space-time.
Well, you have here in this one section of part three, six principles, and space can be distorted is the first. You note that the following six principles are based on the the remarkable properties of this invisible dimension. We hope to maximize the utility of these unique features and apply them toward our specific aim in interstellar travel. Space can be distorted as the first. Then, two is a hole can be created in space. What does this mean?
Well, I sometimes think of a blender. You put things in the blender, you press the button, and then there's sort of a hole in the center. And our idea is that the three rotating lasers will create a vortex, and there'll be a hole at the end. But really, at the end is the what we call our anti-ship, which is a positively charged ship.
We also say that
this spinning vortex is like a Tesla coil, in the sense that you have a copper wire tightly wound around a Tesla coil, and it goes up the column, and it's at a certain angle, and there's a certain number of winds. And so our three lasers, which are charged, are have a magnetic field around them like a Tesla coil.
Mm-hmm. So the next aspect of in dealing with these principles, the third one, is a powerful attraction exists between two quantum bodies. And that is, two quantum bodies are the anti and the positive and the anti.
Or the anti-ship, yeah.
Yeah, and the anti-ship. And they're, but one is a mirror image of the other. Is that correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the quantum particles can tunnel. That particular principle, what does that exactly, what that means when quantum particles can tunnel? Can all quantum particles tunnel?
Yes, it's my understanding that all quantum particles can tunnel. And there's something called a Josephson junction, which shows that particles can flow between superconductors even though they're separated by an insulating barrier.
Okay. Now, I want to get to powering the ship and how that can be powered. But the other, by the way, I'll just mention these other two and the six principles that you mentioned. The inversely matched pairs connect at opposite ends of a higher dimensional Mobius strip. Boy, that is fascinating. And topology serves to create a change in phase. Friends, when you get a copy of this book, go to page 42 and check this out. I think you'll find that fascinating. At least I did. Now, in regards to powering the ship, because I want to go back to this, how will the ship be powered?
Right. We think that it may take some kind of nuclear power, such as fusion or fission. There is a possibility it would take a proton, anti-proton engine source, although that would take a long time. But there's some very, very interesting work going on right now at a lab in Germany, in Munich, Germany, where there's a fellow named Dietrich Hobbs who's working on high-powered lasers. And I'm following that work, or our researchers are following that work very carefully, because he's showing that they might be able to create something called, going through the Schwinger limit, and with these powerful lasers, and we're following how he's going to power them. And it may not be as inaccessible and distant as some theories predict.
And so this ship actually moves then and powers, if the ship works, by shooting out a beam and catching up, the ship actually catches up to and moves through that beam. Is this correct?
Well, it's initially attracted to the end point of that beam, and as it enters the tunnel, it has a very specific signature on the shell of the ship, and we match that signature on the shell of the ship to a distant photon. And because of the Schrodinger probability function, that a ship could be one place or another place, it is attracted to a distant photon.
One of your illustrations on the symbols on the ship, you have a five-pointed star. Is that right, sir?
Right.
And what?
That was just a simple.
It was just.
Being
fascinated with symbols, I just wanted to know if there was. It was just any symbol would have done, but you chose that one. Is that right?
Yeah, I just chose it to illustrate a simple image of a star.
Because that the five-pointed star, and it's is linked to the golden mean and other aspects of it in geometry, which I think is interesting. But we got to take a break here right now with our guest, Paul Kirsch. This Way to the Stars, How Quantum Physics Changes Current Space Propulsion Paradigms, Making Intergalactic Travel a Possibility. Timeless Voyager Press, thiswaytothestars.org, and 1-800-576-8463.
This is Peter Davenport, Director of the National UFO Reporting Center. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and we hope you'll stay tuned for our UFO reports.
Motion and time equals energy. You can't have energy without motion and time. You can't have time.
Okay, M plus T equals E, motion plus time equals energy by a group named Higher Intelligence Agency. Hey, let's go to the Higher Intelligence Agency and get this set up straight here. Awesome. Vocals appropriate for the subject of Paul Kirsch's book, How Quantum Physics Changes Current Space Paradigms. And it's published by Timeless Voyager Press, thiswaytothestars.org, 1-800-576-8463. Now, friends, I'm looking in the glossary of terms because there was so much for me to learn here. And there's a couple of terms here I think I'd like to introduce you to through Paul Kirsch, and that is the Schwinger limit. Now, this isn't S-W-I-N-G-E-R. This is because we already know what that is, but we're talking about the Schwinger, S-C-H-W-I-N-G-E-R limit, the Schwinger limit. Paul, can you tell us about this?
Yeah, it's a wonderful, fantastic thing, and the man behind it is also wonderful and fantastic. The Schwinger limit is essentially the point at which the quantum vacuum comes to a boil. It's the point at which the fabric of space-time gets torn apart. It's named after a fellow named Julian Schwinger, who died in 1994. He published a paper in 1951 in Physical Review, and he showed that at 10 to the 18th volts per meter, the quantum electrodynamic field, or the quantum vacuum, starts to boil. So if we say if the quantum vacuum is made up of virtual particles and antiparticles in pairs, this is the point at which these particles and antiparticles separate. Now, here's something that you can take home with you. Schwinger won the Nobel Prize in 1965, but he was also a good graduate advisor. In fact, four of his students won Nobel Prizes, including Glauber, Mottleson, Glashow, and Cohn. And, you know, for those of us who are sort of rebels, he said something interesting of note here, too. He said he was a supporter of cold fusion before he died, and he wrote that the pressure for conformity is enormous. I have experienced it in editors' rejection of submitted papers based on venomous criticism of anonymous referees. The replacement of impartial reviewing by censorship will be the death of science. And that quote I got from Wikipedia on Schwinger. So even though he won a Nobel Prize, he still had to fight the system, and I think that's an interesting sidelight on the scientist.
Well, and you know, a lot of scientists who finally, well, I'll give you an example. We've had a number of individuals on discussing alternative energies, and Dr. Edmund Storms, especially in his work, The Science of Low-Energy Nuclear Reaction. Most Americans are unaware that over 200 laboratories around the planet, they don't necessarily call it cold fusion anymore. They had to call it something else, like low-energy nuclear reaction, to finally be able to talk about it. But this past administration certainly was of no help whatsoever. This Republican administration in allowing the media to report on this with any kind of intelligence. So I'm glad you brought that up now concerning cold fusion and what happens to scientists who could, that are far ahead of their time, what happens to them when they are actually have a difficult time in even discussing any of this. Now in regards to the Schwinger limit, how will you reach the Schwinger limit with technology?
Right. Well, our idea is with powerful lasers. And scientists around the world are working on this, and they have come close to the conditions of the cores of stars and around black holes. And there's one article on Scientific American called Extreme Light. It came out in 2000 by Drs. Moreau and Umstetter. And they said that short-burst lasers, we're talking femtoseconds, could achieve trillions of watts. And there's another article by someone named Ed Gerstner with the same title, actually, of Extreme Light, and it's in the journal Nature in 2007. And as I understand it, he talks about how if you shorten the length of the time of the pulse of the laser, you can increase the power. So that's how we attempt to reach the Schwinger limit.
Is a large magnetic field important here?
Oh, yes, and it's really interesting. There's been a different test to create powerful magnetic fields, and the Berkeley lab is testing powerful magnetic fields, and they're working with something called niobium tin, and coincidentally, our ship is also made up of niobium tin, so it would have a very powerful magnetic field around it.
Is there any problem in establishing such a high magnetic field today? Can we achieve a large enough magnetic field at this time?
Well, we're still working on some math about that, but we see papers written all the time about increasing the level of the magnetic field, you know, what we can do in the laboratory.
Now, what was the reason why you got so deeply involved in this from the perspective of researching all this material? What led you to this? Did something come to you when you were in graduate school, undergraduate school, or something that you were working out? How did this come about?
Well, I think I was interested in space exploration since I was very young. I used to lie in the grass and look at the sky and wonder, you know, what would it be like to be up there and looking down on Earth?
Mm-hmm.
And then also walking outside at night as a child and looking at the stars and feeling this wonderful experience of the universe. And then the early years of NASA were also a great inspiration for me. I remember sitting in front of the TV set, and anyone who was around from that time period remembers, you know, family all getting together watching the TV as Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. But I have to say that there's also a deep sadness related to the human condition and seeing wars and clashing cultures and a lot of it over territoriality. And that space exploration makes that obsolete. So I've been interested in social justice and saw that space exploration might be a way to respond to that. When I heard about the works of Larry Moore and Mike Miller, I wanted to know what they had to say, and I thought they had a number of novel ideas, and I wanted to put it down in pictures.
Mm-hmm. Have you sent your book or sent the book out to any of these individuals?
Oh, yes, certainly. They gave me input on their work. It was through many long, detailed conversations over really 15 or more years that I began to understand this. Again, I'm not a trained physicist, but I found it so fascinating that I was teaching myself physics. And it was a lot of just studying and thinking of what they said. Again, it's not stuff that can really be taken in a night. It has to be kind of taken in layers of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated stuff, and it's a new way of looking at things.
Now, I think when you take a look at where we are today with all the kind of problems that we're facing in sustaining our planet, how long do you think, this is really not a very good question, but I got to ask it, how long do you think it might take for us to get to the stage of moving consciously in pushing in this particular direction of space travel?
Right. Others have asked me that question, and I don't really know, but I think there's a great potential to bring it forth, and maybe even in our lifetime. It would be incredible if it was. I think a part of it is just assembling some existing technologies and putting them all together as a whole. So you have highly developed individual areas, and then it's a matter of kind of assembling it all together, the material scientists and the quantum physicists and, and all these different, and engineering, of course, and math.
And also your belief that space travel fits in with the ideas of sustainability on our planet, which obviously we are now struggling with. Is that correct?
Oh, right. Certainly, we have concerns about the use of getting too many resources, limited resources, and limits of arable land. There's many motivations to migrate into space over time.
Well, in regards to space travel, why do you think it's important for humans to go from this galaxy to another galaxy?
Well,
I saw some of the illustrations on the inside of what possibility of what as you move from one galaxy going to the next, and it almost looked like Mars, this one illustration you have, right? But I'd like to know what is really at the very bottom of humans' desire to move off Mother Earth and into outer space. Is it just the desire for adventure, or is it something well beyond that?
Well, that's a broad and interesting question that I've been thinking about a lot. In some ways, again, it's for our very survival. I'd like to see the society be transformed from a war-based to an exploration-based society, and to take the energies and intelligence of the highly trained individuals who developed destructive technologies and have them work on constructive technologies.
Well, that certainly would make one positive change in our planetary consciousness, wouldn't it, Paul?
Right.
In order to do something constructive. Unfortunately, we're out of time here. I just caught up on us. Thank you for joining us, Paul Kirsch. The book is This Way to the Stars, How Quantum Physics Changes Current Space Propulsion Paradigms, Making Intergalactic Travel a Possibility. Timeless Voyager Press, thiswaytothestars.org, 1-800-576-8463. And Zahara Hieronymus will be with you next week.
Names and talk on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore.
From ABC News.